Hi, I'm Tim Smith of HCP Live, producer of Lungcast, the monthly respiratory news podcast series hosted by Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association, and produced by HCP Live. Since the ALA and HCP Live launched Lungcast in 2020, the field of respiratory health has evolved dramatically, especially given the COVID-19 pandemic and its legacy. To reflect on this year's most significant headlines in pulmonology, we present our 2024 recap episode, in which we look back at a variety of interview segments that were chosen from this year. We hope you enjoy the recap. If you want, check out the notes below to interact with the interviews you may have missed. In November, Dr. Rizzo spoke with several guests about therapies, triggers, and management of aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease, or AERD.
Let me switch back to Dr. Grayson for a minute to talk a little bit more about the therapy and also talk about a little bit more in general as far as asthma. We know that asthma is now described as having different phenotypes, allergic, eosinophilic, T2, non-T2, and on and on. Can you give us an understanding if this categorization is pretty accurate? And do you feel that the AERD is included in these terms?
Yeah, so that's a loaded question there. So I do think that the T2 high, T2 low, in general for asthma does play a role and is important. And so that's, you know, whether there's TH2, IL-4, IL-5, IL-13 is the T2 high kind of model, IL-17, T2 low kind of model. The problem with AERD is it doesn't quite fit into that definition from a mechanistic standpoint. So when we're talking about, you know, what is driving the disease, it tends to be more of the leukotriene, which are associated with sort of the T2 model. And when we talk about therapy, actually treating for T2 diseases will work. So it fits within that context, but the actual mechanism of why you have the sensitivity to the COX-1 inhibitors and stuff like that does not fit with a true T1 or T2 high, T2 low kind of model. I think that's kind of the difference. When we think about asthma more broadly, we tend to think of it in terms of allergic or non-allergic and response to things in the environment. So in that sense, it is similar that you would have the response to something like aspirin. But people that have AERD have severe disease sort of at baseline, even without taking an aspirin. It's just that if they take something like an aspirin, it very quickly leads to a very severe exacerbation. But often their disease is pretty severe just to begin with at baseline.
In September, Dr. Rachel Eddy spoke to listeners about the current and future uses of AI in lung imaging.
So artificial intelligence is an umbrella term that incorporates various algorithms, including machine learning, deep learning, and natural language processing. Could you please give our listeners a brief tutorial on these different terms and comment on the more recent use of the term generative when it comes to AI and imaging?
Yeah, so such a big topic. You know, I think we could spend the whole podcast talking about this, but I'll try to do this briefly. I've seen these really great visual diagrams that, you know, we can think of AI as a large sort of all-encompassing circle. And AI is generally described as the ability of a machine to learn automatically and display intelligent human-like behavior. AI really relies on big data sets, though, to develop its function in a consistent fashion and to generate reliable results. So diving deeper then from AI as that large all-encompassing circle, machine learning would then be a smaller or medium-sized circle sort of inside of AI, where a machine automatically learns patterns that it sees in the data and uses those patterns to make different decisions about new data. So here the machine learns the mapping from an input to an output using math and statistics such that it's an explainable mapping from start to finish. And we can trace back and understand how the machine mapped that start to that finish. Back to our circles then, deep learning would then be a smaller circle, you know, inside of machine learning that uses more complex algorithms intended to mimic the human brain. And these are typically called deep neural networks that map the input to the output. These networks are called neural because they're meant to mimic how neurons in the human brain signal each other. Deep learning combines math and stats as well, but with these complex neural networks to map the start to the finish. Compared to machine learning, deep learning especially requires really large data sets to learn accurate mappings of that start to finish. However, we don't always know what that mapping is and how the network generated that mapping. This is why deep learning is often called sort of a black box, where we can't actually see inside that box and how the machine learned the mapping. That's a common limitation of deep learning compared to machine learning. There is some novel work going into understanding how we can see in that black box, but we can perhaps save that topic for another day. Despite these limitations, though, deep learning plays, a large role in most of our daily lives, I think now, and has been ex applied quite extensively in lung as well as other kinds of imaging. Either of machine learning or deep learning is not necessarily better than the other, but it really depends on the application and the data available to train the machine or the model.
An August episode of Lungcast featured a discussion of tips for making the return to school as smooth as possible in regard to lung health.
So let's switch gears a little bit. Recent data from the CDC shows that in 2023, e-cigarettes were the most used tobacco product among middle and high school students in the United States. This means that during 2023, 2.1 million, or 7.7% of students, currently used e-cigarettes. This includes about 4.6% of middle school students and 10% of high school students. And among students who had ever used e-cigarettes, close to 50% reported current e-cigarette use among students who currently use e-cigarette use. 25% use an e-cigarette every day. Now, based on what you see in your practices, are you surprised by these numbers? Or do you find that there is continued presence of misinformation around the health risks of vaping among the students, and for that matter, among their parents as well? And how do you address this in your practices?
I think it's an epidemic. And I definitely believe that as physicians, every single day we're fighting this misinformation. At the American Lung Association, I cannot tell you how many parents I say, and they give them the website on the TikTok, because it's so important for them to talk to their kids about vaping before they even get to seventh and eighth grade, because they're starting younger and younger. They found stocks of all e-cigarettes in bathrooms in middle schools and high schools. So if we don't start talking to the kids early on, then they won't know what the dangers are. So really is talking to the parents, talking to the kids in here. And actually some parents have brought the kids into clinic here who are vaping and said, Dr. Mora, their asthma has been off. They started vaping. I need you to talk to them. And so it's really having that conversation. I had one teenager who actually was intubated with an asthma exacerbation secondary to when he started vaping. And so it really scared him. And now I tell that story to my other teenagers that I have here, and I tell them about these dangers. And I'm sure Dr. Sandramelli also has similar stories about the dangers of vaping.
Yeah, so vaping and talking about vaping and getting the word out to our youth is something that I'm really passionate about, and something that I've really enjoyed partnering with the Lung Association with over the years, because I have seen it in my practice. I continue to see people vaping in my practice, and I see the pulmonary harms as well. And that's just the people who are young and doing it and are already exhibiting the symptoms of the harms. Some people may not realize they're harming their lungs until they're a bit older. So the bottom line is there's so much misinformation out there about vaping and e-cigarette use. We know that, unfortunately, use is very common among youth. And even though the rates have varied over the past few years, we've had some ups and downs, it is still way too high. And it's really a sad story, because we were really winning, the battle against tobacco, big tobacco, with our youth. And then e-cigarettes just happened to come on the scene and, appear to be creating a whole new generation of problems, literally and figuratively.
In July, the topic of screening for heat-related illnesses was covered.
I've heard you speak before, and I think one of the techniques you talk about is how to assess or screen individuals for their risk of heat-related consequences.
My background's in emergency medicine. And so I feel like in the emergency department, I would be doing risk assessment sort of after the fact. Basically, somebody would present to the emergency department with a heat-related condition. We'd identify it, manage it, and then we'd talk about how to avoid it in the future. So kind of like secondary prevention, if we want to use like, you know, kind of blanket right. medicine terms here. But I think that there's a really huge opportunity for primary prevention or preventing it before it actually has that first occurrence, both via primary care clinicians, as well as through public health messaging. And I think that there is a, or I know that there's this article that came out in 2022 in the New England Journal of Medicine by Sorensen and colleagues, and it was called Treatment and Prevention of Heat-Related Illness. And I bring this up because it covers screening and prevention for heat-related illness really quite well. And what they say in this, or what they recommend in this, is that clinicians should, for everybody, before the hot season begins where they live, clinicians should be screening all patients for their risk of heat-related illness and then be able to identify heat-vulnerable individuals. And so they can do this in a couple of different ways, or there's a couple different steps to do this. And this is something that I do talk about when I speak nationally and locally on this topic. And so this includes looking at individual factors in the patients to understand their susceptibility. And so understanding what's the patient's age, as we've already covered, young mm-hmm. patients and older patients tend not to be able to fare as well in the heat. Whether that patient or individual has any coexisting conditions, especially lung or kidney conditions, if they're pregnant, if they use certain medications or drugs that maybe may make them more susceptible to heat-related illness for whatever reason, whether they have like cognitive impairments or disabilities, whether they have social isolation or have immobility where they're not able to move themselves out of a hot environment if they do recognize that it is actually hot.
An April Lungcast featured Dr. John Balmes discussing the ALA's State of the Air report.
Dr. Balmes, can you please give your views on what some of the causes are that lead to increases in periodic spikes in particle pollution? And in view of the years that are being covered, please especially comment on the effects of any of the pandemic, and of course the various wildfire outbreaks that have been occurring over the last several years.
Yeah, there are several reasons for why particle pollution is worse in many of the cities that the report covers. So I'll start with wildfires because I live in California and Northern California, where we've had a lot of experience with wildfires. And this has been widely publicized, but all the progress that we've made in recent years with the Clean Air Act enforcement, with reducing particle pollution from the usual sources like diesel trucks, coal-fired power plants, they have been almost eliminated. The benefit has almost been eliminated by the incredible increase in particle pollution from wildfire smoke. And it's not just the Mountain West where I live, where the wildfires generally occur. The prevailing winds push the wildfire smoke across to the East Coast. A few years ago, I was interviewed by a New York radio station because the air quality was bad because of California wildfire smoke. And of course, this year, there's been the Canadian wildfire smoke that has actually impacted the East Coast. We had a relatively good year in California this year. So that's one reason. You know, another reason is that, as we're going to talk about, I think, later in the podcast, the US EPA has determined that there should be a stricter standard, national ambient air quality standard for PM particle pollution. And that means that more cities no longer have healthy air.
Right.
I would say those are the two main reasons why we have so many cities that are getting a bad score this year.
Right.
Another episode highlighted questions on the candidacy of post-infectious COVID-19 patients for lung transplantation and long COVID impacts.
So when we first chatted with Dr. Valapour in 2021, the transplant of patients with respiratory failure due to severe COVID was just starting to make news. I believe it's become a bit more commonplace for post-infectious COVID patients to be candidates for lung transplantation. Has that been the experience at the Cleveland Clinic?
I will tell you that in 2021, so immediately after the pandemic, two new categories of diagnoses became prevalent in as indications for transplant. So one was COVID ARDS, and the second was interstitial lung disease due to COVID. In 2021, one out of every 10 lung transplants were performed nationally for as a result of the complications from COVID. Those numbers have come down now, but that was kind of the impact of the pandemic on the system. Also, the total number of transplants went down during the pandemic, and we are now beginning to kind of inch our way back to pre-pandemic numbers.
I think the, correct me if I'm wrong, Miriam, but I think the most recent publication from the most recent national data that there are almost 400 or so transplants that have been done for COVID-related lung issues. At the clinic, you know, we struggled during the pandemic, I think, as most large lung transplant programs did on how to approach this and how to deal with this. So prior to the pandemic, essentially all lung transplant programs would decline any patient for transplant who was in acute respiratory failure from ARDS or some sort of other etiology. As we've discussed, long-term outcomes are still plagued by issues. Organ access is still difficult and plagued, and we have, you know, more need than at least current utilization is, although many of us are working on ways of increasing the supply. So we sort of saw patients who were acutely ill and very sick and ventilated as just being too risky to consider proceeding with a lung transplant. And obviously all that changed with the pandemic.
In a January episode featuring Dr. Sue Patternacht, the topic of mental health and burnout among clinicians was discussed.
In preparation for this discussion, I did run across the important distinction between being stressed and being burned out. And I'd like you to comment a little bit more on that. And also, if you want to reiterate the fact that stress and burnout can lead to depression, but that's certainly a different issue altogether. So just a little more about the difference between stress and burnout.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. And truthfully, the research is mixed on this. You know, the definition that I cited and the research that was done by Christina Maslach and others from Stanford, such as Tate Schoenfeld, the work of the Mayo Clinic, et cetera, do not conflate it or mix it. But there are constructs in which burnout is a subcategory of stress. And there's other research that would even say that there really the overlap is so great that there isn't really a substantive difference to warrant a separate definition. So with all of that, though, I think that the work that was done up at Stanford does a really good job of parsing out some of the differences. Getting kind of maybe to the end, I would say if you're not sure whether you're stressed or burnt out, don't stress yourself out about defining it. You know, get some help.
Right. Bottom line,
so having said that, don't twist yourself into a pretzel trying to figure it out.
Thank you for listening to our 2024 Lungcast Recap. Have a happy and healthy holiday season.